Welcome to a weekly review of North Dakota's legislative news. Now, here's your host, Dave Thompson, with North Dakota Legislative Review.
And this is North Dakota Legislative Review. I'm Dave Thompson. Thanks for joining us. One of the more anticipated bills of the session, called the Prairie Dog Bill, passed in the state Senate unanimously. What it does is provide a new bucket for oil tax money that cities, counties, townships can dive into to pay for infrastructure projects like streets, things like that. It goes to the governor. The governor will make the final decision whether or not he signs it or vetoes it. Also, this week, the legislature did approve a bill that will raise our driver's license fees. They're going to double them from $15 to $30. This is the first increase in driver's license fees in 33 years, and one of the reasons they did is because DOT was using other funds to help pay for driver's licenses being issued. And we also had the bill that will end taxation of Social Security benefits. Now, North Dakota is only one of a handful of states that taxes those benefits, and the bill passed the House. It's in the Senate. There is a bit of, pushback among some senators who say income tax is low in North Dakota, probably because most everybody has skin in the game. And that was the quote from the chairman of the Senate Finance and Taxation Committee, Senator Cook. This week started off with an optimistic revenue forecast from the state. The next day, a slightly different forecast was presented by the legislative branch. Political correspondent Chad Mira caught up with Senate leadership about these new numbers.
We saw two new revenue forecasts come out this week, and joining me now to talk about it all are Senate Majority Leader Rich Warner and Senate Minority Leader Senator Joan Heckman. Thank you both very much for being here today. Senator Warner, I want to start with you and just get your opinion overall of what we saw in the new revenue forecast this week.
Well, first of all, we expect it to be a little better than what our forecast was in January, and that's exactly what it was, especially with Moody's. However, with IHS, it was a little bit different. We were a little bit surprised at their projections as far as sales tax, which were way down, and I don't think that one was correct, but we're going to work through that, and we probably won't use that low a number as they had projected.
And Senator Heckman, same with you. What was your overall impression, and are you optimistic about what you saw?
I am optimistic. I think one of the things that was good is when we went in before the forecast, we were looking at oil being at about $45, $46 a barrel, and when they came out, Moody's came out, they have it about $49 and $49.50, and that's encouraging. And number of barrels per day is also, at about the levels that we expected, and maybe a little bit higher. So those are encouraging. The discouraging part, of course, was the ag projections across both of the revenue forecasts. I think that it's going to be difficult for our farmers in the next couple of years, but things look steady, and I'm encouraged that we're going to have some funds to do the things we need to do.
You mentioned the oil prices, but also there's a little bit of difference in the oil production numbers that the two forecasts gave us. I believe the IHS market forecast predicted oil production to be a little bit lower. Senator Warner, what kind of challenges does looking at the oil market pose when we're trying to set these numbers?
Well, I think that they were closer than you think. IHS for next biennium was 1.4, but they had it going down to 1.3. Now, when you take a look at Moody's, they started at 1.4 and they went up to 1.44. So they're really pretty close. But we do not believe that production is going to go down. We think it's going to gradually ratchet up. And maybe they started a little bit high, but I don't know. I'm confident that 1.4 is a good starting spot.
Okay. Senator Heckman, we mentioned earlier the difference in the major tax collections between the two. The one from IHS Market came in about 7% or so under what we saw from the states on the first forecast we had this week. What do you think is making up the difference between those two projections?
I would think the analysis is a little bit different. When I listen to both reports, I would gather that Moody's is a little more distinct as far as solid numbers. IHS market is a little bit more what I would call for the financial geeks. They predicted a little bit more and talked a little bit more about the intricacies of each of the commodities. And Moody's doesn't do that. They take the numbers, they plug them in, they give them to us, and they're actually probably easier for the appropriations people to use. IHS market gets a little bit broader and a little bit more in depth into why the soybean market's this, why the oil market is this, and what's happening in different parts of the country and the world. Those certainly have an effect on the money that we take in the state of North Dakota. But as far as appropriations people, they don't have as much to do with the work that they do.
Senator Warner, does this give us any better idea of what we can do moving forward when it comes to some of the major spending issues we've been talking about, whether it be state employee raises or some behavioral health services?
I don't think it changes much. I think we feel very confident in the Senate in our 2 and 3 as we look for inflationary increases and salary increases. I think it substantiates that. And so I don't look at a lot of changes, but it looks like it's going to give us the flexibility we need to do what we were going to do anyway.
Do you agree with that, Senator Heckman?
Well, I think it also gives us a little bit more revenue that our caucus is pushing for a 3 and 3 instead of a 2 and 3. You know, we feel that the funds are going to be there and that we have the opportunity to do that. You know, the last few years that we've been very conservative in everything that we've done, there's a lot of needs out there that we feel that we can meet now after we see these revenue forecasts.
Okay, Senate Minority Leader Senator Joan Heckman, Senate Majority Leader Senator Rich Warner, thank you both very much for your time.
Thank you.
And our guest this week on Legislative Review, State Senator Kathy Hogan from Fargo. She's a Democrat and probably is recognized as one of the more insightful leaders when it comes to the issues of human services and behavioral health. Senator, thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And since you heard him talk, and Senator Wardner has also been one who has been, shall we say, tooting the horn for behavioral health.
Exactly.
How do you think the issue is faring in this session?
We've had excellent hearings on behavioral health over the last 6 or 8 weeks. We've had major consumers and advocates and also providers come in. And so on the table, we have about 15 major proposals, some from the governor's office and the Department of Human Services, many from advocates and consumers. And so now we're in the process of deciding, based on the new revenue forecast, what can we really begin to do to address the crisis?
Now, you mentioned this because the 2013, the biennium came up with the Schulte report. There was another report that led up into this legislative session. And there seems to be at least a realization among everybody that behavioral health is really a forefront issue in North Dakota.
It is. It is. And for the first time, really, we have a detailed roadmap called the HSRI study. And it has 13 very specific recommendations. And we have detailed plans in almost all those recommendations now to move forward to address the unmet needs.
So what's like job number one that's really on the table right now?
I think that's always a tough issue, because how do you compare the needs of a child with a serious mental illness with an adult who's suicidal? And so we often don't prioritize. But what we know we need to do is we need to expand our children's behavioral health services. So many of our programs are looking at expanding what's called targeted case management for children so that we can serve children, and then also expanding behavioral health services in schools. And we've been working very closely with the Education Committee to address the behavioral health crisis in the schools. So I think those two initiatives for children are critical. The second big area that we're looking at is expanding the Free Through Recovery work that we did on Justice Reinvested into non-DOCR clients, so that we can prevent people from going to prison, so that they don't have to be incarcerated first to get services. And that expansion, I think, is very exciting.
Yeah, when you mentioned that, and it was more than anecdotes. Judges were sentencing people to prison because that's the only place they could get behavioral health. One of the barriers seems to be workforce.
Workforce is a huge problem. But we've done some very creative things by expanding the use of peers and the peer recovery supports. We had excellent testimony on if we provide treatment providers with a good solid peer support and a case management system, which is a little more flexible than traditional treatment, we can help people to the road to recovery.
peer support kind of sounds logical to me, because you are you're talking with people who have gone through it.
Exactly.
And they can relate.
And many states have had very good success with peer supports, and there's lots of pieces of peer supports. You have to train and certify them to make sure that they're qualified, but then you also need to provide reimbursement and supervision. So it's building an infrastructure that's new in the state. And we started with Recovery Reinvented, but now I think we're really ready to move on, not just with addiction, but with mental health and with children and families.
Does it surprise you that you just said we're ready to move on? Are you surprised we're now at this point?
No, I think we've been building the steps. I've always said it's a 10,000 piece puzzle, and now, you know, I think we're really filling in some of the major puzzle pieces. And the master plan is what's important, and the roadmap that the HSRI study provides really gives us a blueprint so we can really implement it. One of the pieces the governor's recommended is an expansion of major crisis response, because there's no crisis system really for behavioral health issues. And he's got major, in his budget and in his proposal, major expansion of crisis supports, which many of us are supporting. And then of course there's the discussion about the state hospital. And he had proposed a new state hospital, which we didn't quite agree with, but what we did have was the ability to study that issue and look at a thing called the IMD waiver. So perhaps we can use local hospitals for hospitalizations and not need to send people to the state hospital. So there's a lot of very creative ideas on the table still.
Okay. Well, the state hospital issue was very interesting, because that was a DOCR issue too.
Yes.
In that this domino effect, moving the women out of the New England facility to the MRCC in Bismarck, moving the MRC people to Jamestown, using the old Jamestown State Hospital for a prison.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it already is a prison, of course.
Of course.
And then building a new facility, but it almost was kind of sprung on legislators at the last minute, and there was a lot of concern about that.
I think we have to have a common vision. We can't just have someone give us a blueprint without understanding the details. And there are implications for the facility in New England and all the staff. The other issue is things like New England is often the only addiction provider out there, and so it has secondary impacts on communities. So we need to really think through those major changes, and I think this next interim will do that.
Yeah, one of the things that I heard discussed is that you use the New England facility specifically for addiction treatment.
Yes.
And that's still on the table, perhaps, but maybe not this session.
Maybe not this session, but I think we have to plan that together.
And when you talked about the blueprints are not one of those things that we get it done now and we're done.
No.
Is kind of like a evolving, growing thing.
Absolutely. It's a living animal. It's a living animal.
Yes. Well, another thing that came out of Human Services that I really have to ask you about was this whole idea about reinvention, the zones was part of that, and how interesting that is, because that seems to be almost a revolution rather than evolution.
Actually, I think I disagree with you on that, because the idea of consolidating county-based social services has been on the table since the 70s, since a report called Touche Roche. And so,
I remember. Yes.
So it's been kind of talked about. But over the last 4 years, there's been a growing working group about looking at how we can provide more efficient county-based social services, both effectively with good quality service at the local level, but perhaps by consolidating some service units. And so Senate Bill 2124 establishes human service zones, and the current proposal is between 16 and 19 zones. And those zones will be managed by the locals, and the employees will be local, but there'll be a consistency so that all of the zones will have the same core service.
One of the things that I heard originally when it came out, some pushback saying, are we as local counties going to lose some services? Will they have to drive to get services?
That's been a very hot issue, the driving for service. And one of the pieces in the bill is all current access points, the client get services have to be maintained. So the small jurisdictions will still have an office open. So we've addressed a lot of those concerns. The exciting thing about this is we're also more than just looking at administrative structure. We're looking at service delivery. There's been a pilot project on child protective service to say, how can we be more responsive, lower time frames? And we're actually reinventing all of the core services provided by the counties, which hasn't literally been done, many of them, in decades.
That'll be exciting to watch, but that's going to unfold probably more of a study in the next biennium.
In the next biennium, and maybe over 4 to 6 years. We're starting with child welfare services, but financial assistance services. And some things may end up being state administered. It's got flexibility to provide specialization, at the same time assuring a core delivery service.
But this also gives you an example of just how big an issue human services is. It is the largest budget in state government. And by design it is.
It is. And the county-based delivery system was established in statehood. It was established as counties were responsible for poor relief. We want to maintain a local buy-in and a local understanding, because I think when you have local services, you're more responsive.
And of course, last session, there was the state, quote, takeover, end quote, of social services being, you know, completely funded by the state, which resulted in property tax relief. So there's some benefit there for counties and for county taxpayers.
Yes. But we want to maintain the integration so that things like law enforcement, if you remove a child for a child protection issue, you still have to have a solid relationship with your state's attorney and with your law enforcement and police. So you have to have those strong working relationships also.
Since you're a member of the Human Services Committee, you probably looked at some of these bills to tweak our medical marijuana bills.
And that's been interesting for me in medical marijuana, because I wasn't part of the detailed working group last time, so this is all new for me. And we've had 5 bills that we've had hearings on, and they've been fascinating to me. One is what we kind of call the technical amendments changes, just changing pieces of the law that didn't make sense. And that's a technical correction kinds of bills. The second bill has to do with the physician or the prescriber who certifies previously had to say that they would benefit, and many providers said they couldn't verify that because there wasn't medical evidence. So we're taking some of those requirements out. We're taking requirements that they have to specially certify dried leaves and flowers. So we're looking at all those things. And now we're looking at things like, should we add edibles, or should we add other conditions?
I have to ask, what are your constituents saying to you about the rollout of medical marijuana?
Well, there's a lot of frustration about the delay and this really long, slow delay in this. And when I went door to door, it was often the number one thing people wanted. When is it going to be available? And I think people are now beginning to realize we have it available finally. And many of these tweaks will make it much more accessible. It's one thing to be available, but if you can't get a prescriber to sign a certificate, one of the creative things we did this week was the Veterans Hospital's not allowed to sign a certificate by federal law. And so we worked on an amendment to allow a consumer to send their medical records in and get certified with a medical documentation without the signature of a provider. So we're working on there's 1,000 little tweaks that we're trying to do to make it both available and accessible.
Have you also expanded the number of maladies or?
We have a list. We've had, I think at this point, there's about 19 requests that we haven't acted on that bill in committee yet. That'll be Monday or Tuesday. And so I think we clearly are looking at some. There are some on the lists that there's pretty clear medical evidence that we shouldn't add. So those are the decisions we haven't made yet.
So what do you think the end game is for medical marijuana?
I think it's a work in progress. And I think that we will be back in 2 years with more changes. But I'm really pleased with how both the advocates and the medical community have worked together on this. It's been a very collaborative process.
I'm going to change gears because this week the Prairie Dog Bill was passed about the local infrastructure. Just wondering how you feel about that.
I think that's another example of when the stakeholders really get together and work on something in a collaborative way, The details of that have changed over the last 6 months, but the process has been very collegial and bipartisan, and local governments and state governments have worked together to find a plan that I think is mutually agreeable.
So you voted for it.
I did.
It now goes to the governor's office. It'll be up to the governor. I know the governor had some initial reservations about it, but have you heard anything?
I have not heard anything about that. But I think those projects that work collaboratively together, we really do get to consensus. I think most people don't realize that 80 to 90% of our bills are unanimous. And so I think if those big bills can happen, it creates a much more collaborative session.
And let's put that on the table, because it was a unanimous vote in the Senate.
It was.
With one person absent, it was 46 to nothing. So
it was.
That tells you something. How do you feel about the Theodore Roosevelt Library?
Well, I think over the last 2 or 3 years, we've desperately underfunded core services. And we have to first and primarily fund our education, our higher education, our healthcare kind of delivery system, long-term care, DD. I think if, when we get done with the budget of core essential government services, then I think if there are resources available, I think we should look at how we can work to establish the library. I really like Senator Mathern's proposal on the endowment, because I think first we do needs, and then we look at how is this going to be sustained long-term. And so I think we need to work that project collaboratively, like we've done on the other 2 or 3 projects we've already talked about.
You think there's a chance that could be done?
I think there's always hope.
Okay. Then I have to ask just briefly about the idea of raises for state employees. Right now, the Senate's plan has been 2% the first year, 3% the second year. House's plan was 2 and 2. Democrats are supporting 3 and 3. Do you think 3 and 3 might be still a part of the mix?
I think the other piece that's in the Senate plan is an $80 minimum. And the $80 minimum, I think, is a critical piece. I'd like to have it be 100 or 200, because for the low-end workers who are making $1,000 or $1,100 a month, a 2% raise is literally nothing. And I think to acknowledge those individuals who have really sacrificed over the last 2 or 3 years, that minimum, I think, is a critical piece first to target that. And then ideally, I'd like to do 3 and 3 if we can. But I think the consistencies with long-term care providers, with all of our contract people, is also a critical principle.
All right. Senator Hogan, thank you very much.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Senator Kathy Hogan from Fargo. Grocery stores in small towns can struggle to stay open, and that leaves people struggling to get healthy, fresh food. As our political correspondent Chad Mira tells us, some lawmakers want to find some ways to fix that problem.
Fewer than 100 people live here in Driscoll. Even fewer work here, especially after Norm's Grocery closed down a few years ago.
That's a huge impact.
Representative Jeff Magrum.
When people have to travel for groceries, they tend to buy all their other products at a neighboring community.
This is where Norm's Grocery used to be. You can see a window boarded up, closed sign in the window. There's still stuff inside when you peek in that has been left there for years. Now, the post office that was in this building, the cafe next door, they've both been forced to close since then. All that's left here in Driscoll is the bar across the street and a motel down the road.
For many in Driscoll, that means a half-hour drive to Bismarck to shop, and they're not alone. According to SCR 4013, 15% of grocery stores in towns with fewer than 2,100 people have closed since 2013. And not having a grocery store nearby can be bad for your health.
It's a sort of a quality of life issue.
Senator Jim Dotson-Rodd sponsored the resolution in hopes the state will study the issue to find ways to get good food to rural areas.
Trying to find food in the quantities and quality that you might normally expect to try to get that into some of these rural areas is showed up at a number of different places.
It would look at anything from how stores can stay profitable.
Small town stores just don't have the volume.
To how to keep products on the shelves.
They don't move enough fruits and vegetables, so they can't keep the fresh things on hand.
And if the state can help.
Chad Mira joins us right now. And Chad, given that package, I think that's probably a tough nut to really come up with a simple solution.
Right, and that's why they want to do this study before making any, legislation about the issue. They want to study it for the next couple of years. This is something that if this resolution passes, we'll hear more about in the following biennium. So, but it's an interesting issue because it's one of these issues we hear about a lot. You don't necessarily talk about in terms of groceries, but getting services to rural areas in North Dakota. We see it with the social service redesign. We see it with the grocery stores in this study, but also a lot of the behavioral health proposals. So this is kind of another extension of how do we make sure people who don't live near one of the big cities in North Dakota are still able to thrive.
And your earlier story about the revenue forecast, well, that basically means the puzzle can come together now.
Right, so it gives us a good idea of what kind of money we have to work with. However, we have two forecasts, so lawmakers are still going to look at both and then come up with their own projections somewhere in the middle between the two. Something leadership is working on together, and we don't know where those numbers are going to quite fall, but we have a better idea now that we've seen both those forecasts.
And as the people in the legislature will tell you, it's not two halves. It is a three-period hockey game. We're in the second period now. The revenue forecasts are in, but everybody's got to watch that conference committee thing coming up. Mm-hmm. That'll be interesting too. Mm-hmm. And of course, you've got these revenue forecasts, which will play into that.
It always does. It plays a big role. And also in the presidential library, real quick, that you brought up, we'll see how that has any factor in funding for the presidential library. Senator Hogan mentioned Senator Mathern's proposal. What it would do is require a 3% raise for state employees as well as some additional funding for other things before the state agrees to give money for the presidential library. So with a little bit better of a forecast, maybe some of these proposals are still an option.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us for North Dakota Legislative Review. I'm Dave Thompson.